And on the season for Tony Torres, I mean, it did not start off the way that he was hoping for. His ERA was a bit inflated from a couple of rough performances early on, but certainly has dropped it down to the 420 as this one is belted out towards left field. Gas trying to find it, and he does last second. He'll throw it on in, and it is cut off by Skinner. No throw home. It's a sacrifice fly. It's now 3-1, Von Dulac. RBI for Taylor Freeman, his first in a Doc Spiders jersey, and extends the lead by one. And now it's up to Jalen Gellings to see if he can send that runner on second home. So before that, they didn't want to appeal on down to third to make sure that he did not try tagging up too early, and he did not, so the run did come home to score. Two outs, runner on second base in the bottom of the eighth inning. It's 3-1, the Doc Spiders lead. Pitch on the way home from Torres. It is on the upper part of the zone for strike number one. Jalen Gellings, right-handed hitting third baseman, up at the plate for Von Dulac. Rafters have not scored since the first inning. They've had just one base runner reach since the first inning. Hoping to turn that around. The 0-1 count misses high. Now it's 1-1. So this two-run lead feels pretty safe for the Doc Spiders with the way the pitching has looked. But of course, you can never be too safe in the Northwoods League, especially with the way that the Rafters' offense has looked this season. They've been able to kind of come out of nowhere in certain games. Go back just a couple of games ago, and they almost made a impressive ninth inning comeback. They were down 5-1 in the ninth inning. They didn't quite finish it off. 1-1 count, swing and a miss, brings it 1-2. But in that ninth inning, they were down to two outs with the bases empty, down 5-1. Come back, score three runs, put the tying runner on third base before finally the Rafters were finished off. I was at Traverse City on June 28th, just a few days ago. 1-2 count is outside for all number two, a 2-2 count. So that kind of shows you what the Rafters have the ability to do. They had just the one run kind of the whole game, and then they were able to put up three with two outs in the ninth. So same thing happens here. The Rafters would take the lead. That's why it's so important they keep this a 3-1 game, and this pitch fouled back. So Gelling stays alive. Torres is not able to work out of this inning just yet. And it's going to be frustrating up there on the mound. Torres up to 23 pitches now after that foul ball. It'll be the sixth pitch of the plate appearance from Jalen Gellings. Still a runner on second base with two outs and a two-run lead for the Doc Spiders. Torres looks back towards second, now brings it home, swing and a miss for strike number three, and Torres is able to work out of the inning, but allows the one run on two hits. There were no errors, and there was one left on base. We head to the ninth. Rafters have to score at least twice when we return here on WFHR with Wisconsin Rapids.
Hi everyone, Seth here from Seth Faces the Music. You know, being the host of the award-winning second greatest radio show in the state of Wisconsin can be a lot of work. I have to come up with new themes all the time. So in the interest of clarity, here are some topics I will not be using in upcoming episodes.
Mittens, tinfoil, gastric bypass surgery, window treatments, 17th century Japanese art, outhouses, bowler hats, spam, clog dancing.
Seth Faces the Music, every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. only on WFHR.
Keeping you connected to your local community with good news and great conversation. Here's Terry Barr with the Civic Media Radio Network.
It's Summerfest's third and final round of dates. Can you believe it? We've again made some personal picks for you to enjoy the big gig along Milwaukee's Lakeshore this holiday weekend. Let's start with the music, and some great throwbacks are playing, including Richard Marx, the band Chicago, Fountains of Wayne, even Sebastian Bach. Find the full list of artists on the more than 12 stages at summerfest.com. Friday night, Johnsonville is hosting a huge party for America's 249th birthday. Don't miss singing, cake, and fireworks to cap off the celebration. And here's what I call your new must-do. Grab a free big win ticket at the gate on Saturday. You could walk away with more money than you arrived with. $1 million up for grabs. No kidding. Wishing you a happy holiday. Until next time, I'm Terry Barr.
Let's get back to the rafters here on WFHR, Wisconsin Rapids.
Luke Parise is going to be given the opportunity to finish it off for the Dock Spiders. He is currently in line for the save after coming in the eighth inning and going three up, three down, taking over for Noah Weck. And Weck, man, what a performance from him. The best pitching performance that the Rafters have gone up against. He went seven innings, allowing one unearned run on two hits, one walk, and 12 strikeouts. Here in the top of the ninth inning, the Rafters down 3-1. They will be led off by Royce Clayton Jr. Back to the top of the card. First pitch is seen for ball number one, and the Rafters, they have had their last 10 batters retired in order. They had a single from Hiroto Kobayashi before that, and prior to that single, it was 14 consecutive batters retired. 1-0 count, and Parise steps off the mound, so the Rafters, just one of their last 25 batters have reached base. So with that, it looks like a pitch clock violation going to be called on Luke Parise. So now a 2-0 count. As the pitch comes to Clayton, that one misses inside for ball number three. It's 3-0. Clayton, he drew a walk back in the first inning. That is just one of three base runners the Rafters have had all game. 3-0 count coming on home. That one is on the lower inside edge for strike number one. Clayton thought for a split second that was ball four and started walking on down to first, but that's back into the batter's box, now ready to go with a 3-1 count. Pitch on the way from Parise. That time it misses inside, and he will take his base. First Rafters player to reach multiple times in the game, and it's a second walk for Royce Clayton Jr. He is on first base, and it brings the tying runner to the plate for the Rafters. Down 3-1 here in the top of the ninth inning, and Hayden Carlson up at the plate. And looking at what Hayden Carlson has been able to do this past season playing with the Saddleback Bobcats, his stats, not something that he was able to go out of this world on, but he was still a key piece to the team, and especially defensively as a shortstop for the squad. That pitch missing for ball number one. Carlson looking to get on base any way possible here. And his OBP at Saddleback, not too bad. 346 in conference play. 1-0 count coming home. He watches this one miss outside for a 2-0 count. So he's going to hope to keep up that plate discipline here as he'll be taking on some Northwoods League pitching. But before that, it'll be a quick visit between Jonathan Fitz and Luke Parise. Parise, he was really good in that eighth inning. Three up, three down. He had a strikeout and a one-pitch groundout as well. And here in the ninth inning, it was a five-pitch walk. Actually, four-pitch walk to Royce Clayton Jr. Because one of them was an automatic ball. And then Hayden Carlson is now seeing the first two pitches for ball. So a little bit less accuracy from Luke Parise for the Dock Spiders. Runner on first base, still 2-0 count, taken for strike number one. Back even at 2-1, and Clayton over there on first base, he's stolen a few bases this year. So he is a threat to take off, but the Rafters need two runs. They don't just need the one. 2-1 count on the way, swing and a miss on a high heater to bring it back even at 2-2. Carlson, 0-3 in the game. He struck out looking back in that sixth inning. That was his last time up. Struck out swinging in the third, but grounded out 4-3 back in the first. Pitch on the way. This one misses low. It's now a full count. 3-2 with the runner on first base. Carlson trying to work on any way that he can. First game as a Rafter. Trying to start an on-base streak, and the 3-2 count comes home. Runner taking off. It's high for ball number four. The Rafters now have runners on first and second. Tying runner is on first base. The go-ahead runner at the plate for Wisconsin Rapids. And after domination over about seven innings from the Dock Spiders, finally seeing a little bit of momentum for the Raptors offense. And at just the right time, and this is exactly what I was saying back in the bottom of the eighth inning, the Raptors offense can start clicking out of the blue. That's what it's kind of looking like right now, but they have to finish it off. They've had so many of these near comebacks in the late innings of the games. Hadn't been able to finish too many of them off. The Raptors this season, when trailing after eight innings, are 0-15. Same deal when trailing after seven innings. So looking for that first comeback win, and here in the second half, trying to prove that they're a different team. We'll see if they can, as Junior Barajas will step into the batter's box. Barajas having a quick speech from Ziggy there on the third base line, and this is a huge at-bat. Barajas drove in the only run of the game for the Rafters back in the first inning. It was an RBI double to get things started for his Rafters career. Trying to keep it rolling, he has a big opportunity here. Rafters down 3-1 in the top of the ninth inning. He'll take on the righty Luke Parise. Lefty-righty matchup with the first baseman at the plate. The first pitch taken low for ball number one. Barajas, 1-for-3 in the game. That one hit was the RBI double in the first inning. In the sixth inning, it was a ground out to first. And in the fourth inning, it was a fly out to left field. 1-0 count. Big leg kick, but it misses outside. 2-0, and that's what Parise usually does on his windup. Brings that left leg high into the air, straight out, pointed towards third base, and brings it back to home. Now a 2-0 count, and Parise will bring it in as it's fouled back by Barajas. 2-1 the count. After trying to put up a big comeback here, as well, they led 1-0 all the way up until the bottom of the fifth. They scored that one run in the first inning, and then bottom of the fifth comes around. That's when the Dock Spiders were finally able to get their first run of the game. 2-1 count. Parise looks back towards second, brings it home, swing and a miss for strike number two. Barajas saw the high heater and bit on it a little early. Rafters looking to start the second half off with a victory. Green Bay having claimed the first half crown. They're going to need this. 2-2 count, both runners taking, but the pitch is fouled back to keep it 2-2. Royce Clayton Jr., he was taking off from second. Hayden Carlson was swiping off from first base. And, well, we know a little bit about Clayton, but Carlson on the base paths, not too much that we know about him. Of course, comes into this game from Saddleback University and previously played at Indiana. 2-2 count, pitch on the way home. This one is hammered out towards right center field, high in the sky towards center. Should be deep enough to advance that runner from second. We'll see if it is. Here comes Clayton over to third base, but Carlson will stay at first. So it's a fly out from Junior Barajas. A deep one at that, but ultimately doesn't do the job that the Rafters needed. The tying run still at first base, and it brings up Madden Akko to the plate with runners on the corners and one away, down 3-1 in the top of the ninth. Carlson over on first base. He stole two bases back in his 39 games at Saddleback this past season. He's shown off the ability a bit, but not too much. First pitch on the way to the new batter, Akko, is taken on the lower outside corner for strike number one. Akko up at the plate for the fourth time today. He is 0-3. Back in the seventh inning, that was his last time up. He grounded out 6-3. Flew out to left in the fourth. 0-1 count, taken outside for ball one. Back in the first inning, it was a 6-3 ground out for Mako. Playing second base for the first time today and focused on that part of his game, Raptors have played a clean defensive game so far. 1-1 count, runner taking off, swing and a miss, throw on down to second, swim move, and he's safe as the ball is dropped. And that is a big-time win for the Raptors on that one as they have the tying runner now safe at second base. Nearly had him out at the bag, but instead there's now runners on third and second. Down two runs in the top of the ninth. A 1-2 count to Akko. And the pitch from Parise, it is taken for ball number two. 2-2 the count. And the Raptors had 24 pitches from Tony Torres back in the bottom of the eighth inning. There's a chance he'll come back out, but there's a chance he won't. 2-2 count, swing and a miss for strike number three for Matanaka. But before we can think about the bottom of the ninth, the Raptors have to at least tie this one up, and they're down to their last out. And it comes up to the returning Raptor from last season, Landon Gaz. And Gaz, previously playing for UC Irvine back in this past spring. Gaz, a guy who, with UC Irvine, he had 29 at-bats as that pitch is in there for strike number one. So he's seen some plate appearances at the Division I level. In his 29 at-bats, did struggle a little bit, but was able to draw 7 walks and pick up 5 hits. Has an 0-1 count here, and last season with the Raptors, trying to improve on that. 0-1 count sent to the right side of the infield. Picked up by the second baseman. Throw over first. Had to be rushed, but they got him in time, and that does it for the game. 4-3 putout finishes off the ninth, and the Raptors can't get the victory to start off the second half. They fall to 0-1 with the final score 3-1. The Dock Spiders win in the ninth inning. No runs, no hits, no errors, and 2 left on base. 3-1 the final score once again, but before that, we are going to go ahead and hit a quick break. Post-game show comes back after this here on WFHR Wisconsin Rep.
I'm the threat that's already inside the house. In the closet, under the bed, in the car. But I don't want your money or your TV. I can't be scared away. Negotiated with. I'm patient and quiet. I don't sleep. You can't call the cops on me. You can't even see me. I'm the threat of family fire. And as long as your guns aren't stored securely, I'll be there. Protect your family. Secure all your guns. Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. That's endfamilyfire.org. A public service announcement brought to you by Brady and the Ad Council.
Hey everybody, glad you could join us. I'm Tim Hubbelt, better known as the Polka Guy, on the Sunshine Polka Party Variety Show.
Join Tim every Saturday and Sunday for a great variety of polkas, waltzes, and more. Wake up at 7 a.m. on Saturday morning to get the weekend started on the right foot, then enjoy a lively Sunday afternoon at 1 p.m. Same great show, two different times, one fun weekend. The Sunshine Polka Party Variety Show, 7 a.m. Saturdays and 1 p.m. Sundays, only on WFHR, locally grown radio.
Let's get back to Raptors baseball here on WFHR Wisconsin Rapids.
Well, not the ending to the game that the Raptors wanted to see. They dropped to 0-1. Fond du Lac improves to 1-0 in the second half of the season, and the Raptors gonna have to work an uphill battle. They dropped the first game of the first half, so they have yet to see a winning record this season, and that's a little bit of an unfortunate turn for them, but they've still got plenty of season left to turn it around, and well, they're going to hope to do the same thing tomorrow when they take on the Dock Spiders once more. And the Raptors had the tying runner on second base, but couldn't bring him around to score. Final score was 3-1. Let's look at back at how it happened. Pretty easy one to recap. First inning, the Rafters had an RBI double from Junior Barajas, which made it 1-0. And from there, absolutely nothing going for them. The Rafters would see just three more base runners throughout the game, a single in the fifth inning, and back-to-back walks to start off the ninth, and nothing else. No other base runners would reach for the Rafters, and that led to their demise. Noah Marschke, he was the first Rafters pitcher since 2021, over 4 years ago, to have 10-plus strikeouts in a game. He went four innings without allowing a run. He allowed two hits and four walks, along with his 10 Ks on 17 batters faced and 83 pitches. Handed it off to the bullpen, and Tyler Bocchetti came into the game. It was not his night. He allowed two runs on two hits and one walk. He hit three batters with pitches in an inning and two-thirds, faced 10 batters and threw 29 pitches, and after three straight hit-by-pitches had to be taken out of the game. It was 1-1. When he came out of the game, a wild pitch from Brent Gallegos with the bases loaded, with runners on the corners, sent the runner from third on home to score, made it 2-1, the Dock Spiders, and then in the eighth inning, they added one more insurance run on the sacrifice fly from Taylor Freeman. That made it 3-1, and that's where the final score stood as Luke Parise came in and locked it down for the save. So the Rafters dropped it 3-1. Taking a look back at the stats, not too much to talk about offensively, although I will say Clayton worked on base twice. He had two walks in the game, not bad from the leadoff spot, and Junior Barajas had the RBI double. And from the pitching side, Brent Gallegos, an inning and a third without allowing a run, Tony Torres allowed the one run over his one inning of work and also had one strikeout. Gallegos had two strikeouts. Got to mention that, but that's about it from the Rafters here, as we're going to go ahead and keep looking at the way that things looked for the Rafters going forward, as the Rafters will go ahead and return here to Fond du Lac tomorrow. It's another game at 6:35 p.m., so pregame show will go live at 6:20 once more. But that's going to do it. A big shout out to the hospitality from the Dock Spiders. They are all great people, always a good crew here, and glad that I got the chance to get to talk to all of them as well. And Parker Poro for helping me get set up over here out in front of the press box. Also, a big shout out to our pregame guest of the show, Ziggy, the manager, Tom Zaglowski, for the Rafters. And of course, another shout out to WFHR for hosting us as always. But that's going to do it from our broadcast tonight. One more time, final score, Rafters 1, Dock Spiders 3. For myself, Austin Thomas, and from the rest of the Wisconsin Rapids Rafters, thank you, and have a great rest of your night.
That's true for Democrats, that's true for Independents, that's true for Republicans. And there's a long-standing, it's really great. Sometimes when you, there have been a lot of focus groups and everything that show this, that when you explain to Republican voters in plain words describing what a Republican plan is, they assume you're lying, because they say, well, no way would someone actually support this. But it turns out that their elected officials do, and then just lie to them about it, right? You know, they say, oh, well, we're not kicking anyone off of Medicaid. We're only going after the moochers. Oh, no one is actually going to be hurt by this. Oh, no, actually, this helps the poor more than the rich. You know, give me a break, right? This literally would give twice as big a tax cut to people who make $1 million a year than to the bottom half of America combined, right? And they say that it helps the poor more than the rich, right? They're just lying about what they're doing, and some people eat it up.
And this is where, I keep coming back to our media structure. I keep coming back to, the fact that you've got the Fox Newses and the mouthpieces for corporate America who I don't even know that this is good for them either so much, because if you're pulling all of this demand out of the economy, you're taking money away from Medicaid, you're taking money out of SNAP, you're taking money out of investing in a whole bunch of things. I don't know how it's good for them really either, other than, you know, they got the short-term tax cash to put in their pocket, the windfall. But I don't know how this helps us. I don't know how this makes us as a country better. And I sure don't buy the whole, you know, we're a Christian nation and we care about the children and we're pro-life. I don't buy any of that garbage, but I don't know how it helps us.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because the Congressional Budget Office similarly found that this would eventually harm the economy. They found it. The Yale Budget Lab found it. Penn Wharton Group, who basically is a center-right group, also found that this would just harm the economy in the long run, right? And in harming the economy, it actually makes even more people worse off, right? By kind of giving people worse, you know, worse negotiating power, making the labor market softer, therefore you get lower raises and everything. The long-term effect of all of this is just a poorer America. Yeah. And so much poorer, I just want to be clear, so much poorer that even with your tax cut, which, by the way, is only $14 per week for the average household making below 100K, it's $14 per week is the tax cut they're getting, whereas the richest folks are getting, you know, 300 grand a year or whatever. Despite that, you end up poorer in the long run because your wage gains have been lower. That's not according to me. That's according to the Congressional Budget Office.
Whoa, hold on, hold on. Just yesterday, I talked about the White House put out a press release, said that, the wage growth in the working class hasn't been higher in the last 60 years. It's the highest right now that it has been in 60 years. They put out the press release. It's got to be true.
Yeah, it's got to be true. So funny, you know, in
the, it was on the internet. It was on the internet, Bobby.
They couldn't put it on the internet if it weren't true. Last time Trump was president, wage gains basically really picked up at the end of 2015. It took basically after the Great Recession, wages were pretty stagnant because workers had no negotiating power. You asked for more money, and if you were lucky enough to have a job, your job said, good luck somewhere else if you can find a job. But eventually the labor market got strong enough that their wages could start going up again. That started, if you look at the trend, it really began in late 2015 and really just continued. And then when Trump passed his tax cuts for the rich, he took credit for this wage gain that had started years before it was passed. In fact, under the previous president, Trump said, aha, it was my tax cuts that did this. It's amazing their time-traveling power that they have.
But again, you know, I keep coming back to, they've got a media structure. They've got an empire. They're in working class ears, in their eyes. It's what they consume. So the lies and the misrepresentation and, you know, just the basic, you know, BS narratives, that's all they get. And this is where I keep coming back to. We need better media in this country.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, you cannot make someone consume information they don't want to consume. And also at the same time, you can't make people report on stuff that they don't want to report on. We have a money incentive structure for a lot of media. And also we have an attention span issue for a lot of consumers of information. I think you put those together and we're in a pretty tough place.
Yeah, I got to think, you know, those kitchen table economic issues are pretty, pretty important. You know, talking about granny getting kicked out of a nursing home or stealing food out of the mouths of children. Look, if I were someone who was easily offended, that would offend me. Don't care where someone goes to the bathroom, but if you're starving kids and you're taking food out of the schools, never mind. Last question I've got for you: I know we already talked about this, but marching orders on how maybe you make this less bad or stop it altogether. What do we do?
Yeah. So parts of the less bad, there are more birdbaths to be happening, right? That is where they are fighting before the Senate parliamentarian. Democrats have been doing well. The staff have just really been crushing it. And we expect more good victories to make it slightly less bad. I do want to be clear, even with all of our enormous victories, it is still a bill that will be the largest Medicaid cuts ever and the largest SNAP cuts ever. But it is less bad. So more of that to happen. And then I would just say the right thing to do is to reach out to your representatives. They need to hear from you. This is the week of action, and not just your senators. I really mean, call back the House of Representatives. The House passed it assuming that it would change in the Senate. They say, okay, well, this will look different. I'm just going to the next step for now. But if it passes the Senate and goes back to the House, then it is for real. And they need to hear again, no, I really, really, really don't want to lose my Medicaid. I don't want to lose my staff. And I would just say to every single person listening right now, I guarantee you, you know someone who would be hurt by this. I guarantee you. It might be you. It might be someone in your family. It might be someone on your block. And it might be someone in your extended network. But I guarantee you, every single person knows someone who would be hurt by this. And just to give one example, When Georgia did Medicaid work requirements, they got a poster, you know, the governor got a poster child, someone who was on Medicaid, who worked really hard, called all the other Medicaid recipients, moochers, and said, this is great. I think this is how it should work. That guy got kicked off his Medicaid twice within under a year when Georgia did Medicaid work requirements. He no longer supports the program because he sees that these things are disastrous. So I guarantee you, you know, people you know will be hurt, and you owe it to them. You owe it to the people who you know, and you owe it to the people who you will never meet.
Or you owe it to yourself, Bobby. Look, any one of us could run on hard times and need this vital social safety net program. Any one of us. Bobby Kogan, I appreciate the time. Senior Director of Federal Budget Policy there at the Center for American Progress. Thanks so much.
Rick, thanks so much for having me on.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Do you see maybe how this could affect you? Do you want to have this social safety net in case? I think it's kind of important. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Back after this.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR. As Wisconsin is hitting the road on your Harley, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly clear tonight, a low in the low 60s. Partly sunny for tomorrow, maybe a stray storm, a high in the mid-80s. And upper 80s on Thursday, another slight storm chance. A couple of storms around for the 4th of July, and temps in the upper 80s and muggy. Currently at 75 degrees.
This one goes out to the elder millennials. We're not as flashy as those other millennials and not as grungy as Gen X, but our music deserves another listen. Burn Before Listening features hits, no, we can't read them out, good face. Deep cuts, and some authentic cringe. This is how you remind. From 2000 to 2009, Burn Before Listening on 97.5 FM, 1320 AM, WFHR, Sundays at 9 p.m.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I talked about the other day, you know, we've all had those moments where we have brushes with either being accused of being homeless or, you know, people who actually are. And my latest, and I talked about this extensively the other day, my latest brush with it was my wife just wanted to get a nap. And we were at the doctor's office, or the doctor's facility, and there was a couch and she was laying down. That's all it was. We were just sitting there laying down. And three times accosted by just people coming by going, what are you doing here? Do you live here? What? It was surreal. And to think that, you know, just average everyday working people have taken it upon themselves to really just harass people for no reason kind of gets me. But here's the thing. We're coming up on the 1 year anniversary of the Supreme Court deciding that being homeless is now can be criminal. And here to share some thoughts on what this last year has been like, I've asked Jesse Rabinowitz to come talk with us. Jesse's the campaign and communications director with Homeless Law, their website, homelesslaw.org. Jesse, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick. As you mentioned, this Saturday is the 1 year anniversary of the Grants Pass decision, when the Supreme Court said that cities and states and even the federal government are allowed to arrest, ticket, fine people experiencing homelessness for just being outside, even if they have nowhere else to go. And it's incredibly shameful. And the past year has proven how disastrous this decision has been.
Yeah. And to be honest, look, I've always been an advocate for sane laws to help homeless folks, to get, you know, people shelter, to get them jobs, to get the services and the things that they need. In fact, for a number of years, we used to do a Hungry and Homeless for the holiday event where we'd live in the supermarket parking lot to raise money, food, and awareness. But it's only been really recently that it hit me that someone accused me. And then all of the mechanisms of what's possible began to become apparent. Because, look, my wife was in a near fatal motorcycle accident back in September. You know, we've been doing just all kinds of medical stuff. And her day's very long and with a traumatic brain injury, wants to rest all the time. And in this moment, I was just like, is this what it's like? Is that just average, ordinary people, not even police or administrative folks, just average folks giving you a hard time? That's frightening to me, Jesse.
It's terrifying. We are seeing a complete erosion of any sort of empathy in this country. And we know that as we trend towards an autocratic regime, it's going to be people who are least sympathetic to the general public who are attacked first. And that's certainly trans folks and migrants, but that's also people experiencing homelessness. We have underestimated how much people in this country just hate homeless people. In the past year since the Grants Pass decision, we've seen 320 cities introduce laws that make it a crime to be homeless. And over 260 of them have passed. None of those laws help people. None of those laws fund housing or supports. All they do is make it easier to throw folks who are experiencing a crisis in jail because they can't afford to pay rent in a country where half of people struggle to get by. These aren't solutions. All they do is make homelessness worse and make it easier to kick people while they're down.
Yeah. I shared my story of because look, I understand, had I thrown a stink, who knows what happens now in this day and age with, all of the rules that we now have in place for people being angry in public, let alone being homeless in public. Anything on your side, anything that you've seen personally on how this ruling has affected folks? Anything?
I've seen so much. I mean, two tragic stories come to mind. In California and in Georgia, we know of people experiencing homelessness who were actually killed when the government came to use backhoes and other heavy machinery to destroy their encampments. In Kentucky, where they have a billionaire-backed anti-homeless law, we saw a woman who is in active labor get cited for sleeping outside, for violating the camping ban. The police didn't offer to help her. They didn't actually believe she was in labor, and she gave birth to a healthy kiddo later that day. But can you imagine being in labor and being told here's a ticket by the very people who are supposed to help you? And for me, I was in Deschutes, Oregon in May, when the Trump administration evicted nearly 200 homeless folks from the National Forest by threatening them with $5,000 in fines or up to a year in jail, all because they were sleeping outside in a city, in a state, and in a country that has no housing that people can afford. These encampment evictions are incredibly expensive. They're deeply traumatic. And most importantly, they keep people homeless longer. I believe that all of us want to solve homelessness, maybe for different reasons, but I don't think anybody wants to see people living outside. But this focus on these backwards, billionaire-backed laws actually make the problem worse. The only way we're going to solve homelessness is by connecting folks with housing and supports they need. And when we do that, we build communities that are healthier, that are more just, and that are more vibrant, and where everyone has the support they need to thrive.
I would like to agree with you. I really would. I'd like to agree that that not everyone wants to take any joy in people's misery. But I got to tell you, recently I look at my Republican friends and I look at the leadership there, and I got to tell you, I don't know. I used to believe we were a country that wouldn't let someone die on the street. I used to believe we were a country who believed at least somewhat the Christian nation rhetoric. You know, that guy that used to run around talking about feeding the hungry and clothing the naked and caring for the sick and the elderly. I used to kind of think we were that country. But I got to tell you, with over 200, I guess your numbers, with over 230 laws passed last year to criminalize homelessness, I don't know.
I do think these laws, and I know these laws, are deeply unpopular. In a recent survey from ACLU and YouGov, we see that over 70% of people from all parties, agree with us that we need housing, not handcuffs, and that throwing folks in jail or punishing them for being poor is not a good or effective solution. And although we have seen a tremendous amount of laws pass on the city level, we have seen nearly we've seen about 50 laws introduced on the state level that make it illegal to be homeless, and nearly 80% of those laws have been defeated. So when people are able to hear these stories about how these laws don't work and make homelessness worse, we can change things, we can make a difference. But people are so rooted in this belief that homelessness is a personal choice and a personal failing. And we have to do much better to educate people and help them understand that homelessness is caused by housing that's too expensive. And we know that for every $100 rent goes up, homelessness increases by 9%. Half of renters in this country struggle to pay rent. This isn't just about the 700,000 people who are sleeping outside right now. This is about the tens of millions of renters who are at risk of homelessness. And all of those statistics were before the White House and before the Republican Congress published their regressive, anti-poor, anti-worker budget. So we know that if this budget is allowed to pass, just like these anti-homeless laws, all they're going to do is hurt people and make more people homeless and keep them homeless longer.
Yeah, I've fought that battle here in my local community when we used to do our Hungry and Homeless for the Holiday events, because people have this idea of who the homeless are. They're all drug addicts and they're all lazy, and that's the narrative. But what I found, sadly, in our community, a lot of it was, a lot of folks struggling with mental illness. And when the state closed the state mental hospitals and gave people nowhere to go, they went to the streets and then ended up, you know, going in and out of the jails. But the other one, and the one that, you know, most people are surprised by, are working people. People who work in your fast food restaurants, looking at low-wage jobs. Folks who, the car broke down, and they lost everything. And it's really sad that we don't have a mechanism to help those folks.
Absolutely. To respond to many of those points, certainly the closing of mental health institutions contributed. But at the same time, the Reagan administration gutted tens of billions of dollars for housing. So at the same time as folks were being kicked out of mental institutions, we were seeing a historic erosion in housing that people needed. And unfortunately, it appears we're on track to hit another significant gutting of these social safety net programs. There's a new book out by a buddy, Brian Goldstone, called, I believe it's called There's No Place for Us, but I could be wrong. So,
you know, I have a friend who, she's written a number of books on she's one of the big homeless advocates that I know. And she said, you know, in her view, the number one reason that people end up homeless is a car repair more than $400. And you stop and you think about that. In this country, where an enormous percent of people are two paychecks away from disaster, to have a government that's now saying, if you do hit that road, that bump in the road, if you do end up in this crisis, we're going to lock you up instead of helping you. Just, I'm still stuck with that. I know I shouldn't be. I know I should be going, what's the solution? But I'm still stuck with that.
And this isn't new, right? The Supreme Court made it a lot easier for cities and states to throw people in jail for being homeless. But these anti-poor, anti-vagrant laws have been around since the foundation of this country.
Sure.
We just find new ways to punish people who are poor, but they don't work.
Like putting spikes on the wall and putting dividers on the park benches and all of that stuff designed to make someone whose life is already uncomfortable even more so. So let me ask you this. Are there any places that are doing things right, that are doing things well? Anything that you would say, hey, this is kind of the model of what we should be doing? All of this stuff over here that we've just been talking about, this is not the way to do it. Is there a way to go, hey, this is what we should be doing?
Nobody's doing it perfectly, but there are certainly cities that are doing a better job. Newark is a good example. Some cities in Texas, Austin is a good example of cities that have changed how zoning works so you can build more housing, and cities that are focusing on getting folks support and housing that they need. One good proof point of this is veterans homelessness. We have seen historic reductions in veterans homelessness across the country because the federal government put resources into it, which shows that homelessness is not some intractable problem. It's actually not rocket science. If you get someone housing and you get them support, they don't live outside anymore. But for most people, they don't have, there's not enough funding to go around. And that's even before these budget cuts come down the pipe. But I saw it in DC where I was a homeless street outreach worker, that when folks got housing, they got better. They lived inside, they had an apartment, they went to the doctor, they reconnected with family. Their lives improved, and the lives of the community improves too, because everyone is healthier when we're all healthier. But unfortunately, it seems that the only thing that politicians can think of right now is throwing people in jail. And it just doesn't work. So we're really excited. 11 states have introduced a version of the Gloria Johnson Act, named after the same Gloria Johnson from the Johnson versus Grants past Supreme Court case. And this legislation says cities can't arrest, ticket, or otherwise criminalize homeless people unless they give them an adequate, decent place to go. And next week, this law is going to be introduced in Congress by Representative Jayapal and Frost, called the Housing Not Handcuffed Act. And we hope this jumpstarts the conversation and forces elected officials to refocus on real solutions to homelessness, like housing and support, because we know housing is too expensive for most people in this country. And until we address the fact that right now housing is treated as a commodity that rich people can use to get richer instead of something that we all need, we're going to keep having people living outside, and we're going to keep having millions of people one paycheck away from homelessness. But it doesn't need to be like that. We can solve homelessness, and we can actually have a country where everyone has housing that meets their needs. And when we do that, we're going to be a safer, healthier, and more just community.
Yeah, as we found out during the pandemic, there's a way to end childhood poverty. Give parents money. There's a way of doing this. We've just chosen not to. In fact, we could easily solve these problems. But again, we've chosen to enrich a minority of folks in this country, our billionaire class. And we're doing it again with this big, beautiful nightmare of a budget bill that they're going to ram through. They're going to cut Medicaid. They're going to cut into Medicare. They're going to go after they're going to take food out of the mouths of children so that we can give massive tax cuts that never trickle down. But those are the priorities.
And it's all connected, right? There's a billionaire named Joe Lonsdale out of Austin, Texas, who made his billions at Palantir selling facial recognition technology to ICE and the government to deport migrants. And Joe Lonsdale started a think tank called the Cicero Institute, based out of Austin, which is peddling these racist, backwards, anti-homeless bills in states across the country. He is friends with Elon Musk. He is friends with J.D. Vance. He is friends with Peter Thiel. And he had a meeting at the White House a few weeks ago. These billionaires are the same people behind these budget cuts are behind this push to make it illegal to be homeless. And we are very clear that we need housing and support, not tax cuts for the rich and handcuffs for the poor, because most people are so much closer to sleeping outside than they are to becoming a millionaire like Elon Musk or his friend Joe Lonsdale.
No, it's an excellent point. And I go back to, you know, my high school civics teacher, when I asked him, how do you know which party that you're going to align with? And his answer was, you know, all these years later, still spot on. You know, Republicans are for big business, the very wealthy, limited government. They're not going to do much for you, but they're not going to be always too deep in your pocket. Democrats are for, you know, big government, big social programs for the poor. And you folks in the middle, you're going to pay for both. So decide which one you're closer to. And I find that to be, you know, as I get older, an excellent explanation.
And the Democrats have not been good on this issue, right? I was out there when Joe Biden and his National Park Service evicted about 50 homeless folks from the McPherson Square Park in D.C. The Biden administration was not good on the criminalization of homelessness. And we see, you know, Gavin Newsom out in California, who is positioning himself as the anti-Trump and is certainly doing a good job responding to ICE. But he's actually taking the same pages from the Trump playbook to respond to homelessness by encouraging cities to make it illegal to be homeless. We need a political system that works for the many and not for the few. And instead, we see politicians of both parties passing these laws that make homelessness worse at a time where more and more people across the country of all parties and of no party struggle to pay rent. The lack of affordable housing is, in my mind, the biggest driver both of inequality but also of hardship for most people in this country. Yet politicians are not talking about it in ways that they should. I wonder what a campaign might look like if they focused on ensuring that everybody had a safe place to live.
No,
I think that would be a galvanizing political campaign.
And ensuring that, you know, people don't, when they lose their job, don't end up homeless, their standard of living doesn't fall, that we have a reasonable living wage, that we have health insurance and education for our children. All of these things. I wish there was a party that really focused on that wholeheartedly. I do. I want to talk about the Housing Not Handcuffs Act. What outside of saying that you can't criminalize homelessness. What else does this do? Or is that just it? We're just saying you can't criminalize it. Is there anything to help, move in a policy direction? Is there a way to help, funding for states to do things, anything?
Yeah, so this bill is introduced in direct response to the Supreme Court ruling last year, and it's very simple. It says federal agencies can't criminalize homelessness. That's it. It's very simple. It doesn't impact what states can do, although states are introducing similar versions of the same legislation. But you're right, this bill in and of itself isn't going to solve homelessness. So we're hoping what happened in Miami happens across the country. There was a federal ruling that said Miami couldn't throw folks in jail for experiencing homelessness. And Miami, because they still were a tourist district and wanted people to come downtown, decided, well, if we can't throw folks in jail, we got to do something. And they expanded the supply of housing and shelter, and they reduced homelessness by half. That's what we want cities and states to do. Unfortunately, the consent decree that was prompting Miami's action expired. They went back to throwing folks in jail, and homelessness went back up. So we see, again, these things don't work. But if politicians don't want to see folks living outside, the only way they're going to meaningfully address homelessness is by funding housing and support. And that needs to happen at the city, state, and federal level. Unfortunately, for the first time ever, we have a HUD secretary who's asking for the funding for affordable housing to be cut. That's not going to help anybody. All that's going to do is to create more people experiencing homelessness and place this burden further on cities and states who are already strapped and already struggling with the demands that they're met with. We have to fundamentally change how we do housing in this country. Housing should not be something that you can only afford if you're wealthy. Housing is a basic human need. We all need a place to sleep. We all need a place to wash up. And when we ensure that everyone has the housing that they need, we are healthier, we are safer, and we're better for it.
There you go. Jesse, I appreciate you taking some time for us, explaining and walking me through all this. I appreciate it. Hope you'll come back if and when this bill passes and keep us up to date on what's going on.
Absolutely. And check out our website, housing.handcuffs.org. We're going to have a bunch of information about the Housing Not Handcuffed Act up in a few days. So folks should tune in and check it out. Thank you so much, Rick.
I appreciate your time, Jesse. Jesse Rabinowitz, Campaign and Communications Director there at Homeless Law. Check out their website, homelesslaw.org. Want to hear your thoughts. Have you experienced homelessness? Have you been harassed, intimidated, any of that? I want to hear the stories. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'll take a quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1971. At 2:51 a.m., Battalion 12 Chief Leo Najarian of Los Angeles heard that there had been a tunnel explosion. That February, a 6.5 earthquake had killed 65 people in the area. Now it seemed tragedy had struck again. Just the night before, Chief Najarian had been called out to the same address. The Lockheed Shipbuilding and Construction Company was digging a tunnel over a mile long for the Metropolitan Water District. Chief Najarian had been called out when four workers were injured due to a minor explosion. He had found that the workers at the site were not testing frequently enough for methane gas. One spark from a tool could touch off an explosion. Leaving instructions to test more frequently, he left and spent the next day worried. So when another explosion alarm came from the same address, he rushed to the scene. There he found the second explosion was much worse than the first. Workers were trapped 5 miles into the tunnel. Rescue workers attempted to reach the trapped miners through a vent shaft near their position. Paul Badgley, a miner at the scene, was part of 4 rescue attempts. He described the heartbreaking effort, stating, quote, "The first time we went in there, I could hear the guys hollering for help. The third and fourth time, I couldn't hear them. It's a hell of a feeling not being able to help them when you hear them hollering." 17 workers lost their lives. In the aftermath of the tragedy, the Lockheed Company was put on trial and fined heavily for their negligence. California passed stricter mining and tunnel laws and established a state Occupational Safety and Health Administration. 19 Los Angeles firefighters were awarded the Medal of Valor for their bravery. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter @laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Isn't it amazing? I mean, honestly, that communities across this country are trying to criminalize the downtrodden. I mean, that's the part that gets me. And I guess it goes back to my religious upbringing. I grew up in the Catholic Church in the 70s, where peace and social justice were still the focus. We hadn't gotten to greed and abortion yet, they were greedy. Let's not get carried away. But, you know, the idea of helping in the community, of not allowing laws to be passed to criminalize people who are we're kicking people while they're down. That's basically what we're doing. And understand, homelessness shouldn't be a crime. It's a crisis rooted in our systematic failure to address anything that we, the people, need. And instead of what we're getting from a lot of my Republican friends, especially, is, and look, there are Democrats who are just as heartless because, hey, got to stay in office. And it's, you know, we don't want those unsightly people. We should be doing something positive. And I've been saying for years, you know, we've got to be investing in affordable housing. There's no reason that you can't have housing developments for working poor and working class people. We build these giant McMansions, we build these huge developments, and what do we get? Nothing for poor people. No moderately sized little bungalows like my grandparents' generation built. So what we need is we need to build affordable housing, and that can only happen through government programs. Understand, you know, you look at the fabulous 40s and 50s and into the 60s, that was built off of government investment, massive amounts. So we need to invest in housing. Absolutely. Expand rental assistance, emergency shelters, supportive housing. You know, in Denver, as I remember, they've got an old warehouse that they turned into a living facility for people who have little rooms, and they're all the support services you need. There's a gym. There's all kinds of stuff to deal with people where they are. But we need more than just temporary solutions. We need actual housing. And this is where I thought Kamala Harris, you know, made a mistake and going, oh, we're going to give people $25,000 to buy a house, their first time home buyers. No, that's, again, easily divided. I was like, build houses and put people in them. We've got to have policies that are going to help heal our communities. And that starts with jobs. That starts with, if the private sector can't or more likely won't create enough reasonable paying jobs, the kind of jobs that you can live on, then the public sector has to. There's a lot of stuff that needs to be done. There's a lot in the care economy we should be doing. That you could pay people to make a living, to be able to put food on the table, keep a roof over their heads, and not end up homeless. But we're not going to do that, because there's no profit in it. And that's the sad reality. We've been sold on the idea that greed is good and the one who dies with the most toys wins. And the sad reality is it's never us. It's never the working class that gets the most toys. We're the ones who pay for it. And for me, in this moment, I'm disgusted by what I see coming out of Washington. And I hope other people are looking at Republicans, you know, the family values people, the Christian folk. And what they're doing is, well, immoral, unethical, wrong. Throw the word in there. I thought that they stood for something. I know. You got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, right? Isn't that the argument they make? It's disgraceful what they're doing. And they should be called out on it. It should be one of these scenarios where we're talking to people and saying, look at these folks. Look at how immoral they are. Shame. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Do you have an idea? Is there somewhere in your community that's doing it right? I've seen some places with those little tiny homes. It looks cool as you know what. I'd love to hear it. Are there things out there that we could be passing along as best practices? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is locally grown radio.
WFHR 1320 AM, W248DE Wisconsin Rapids.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. A partial verdict has been reached in the federal sex trafficking and racketeering trial of Sean Diddy Combs. The jury was not able to reach a decision on racketeering charges. CBS's Jerika Duncan reports.
The juror note said that there were some jurors that had unpersuadable opinions, but the judge instructed them to deliberate some more. They've only been deliberating about 12 and a half to 13 hours. Remember, they just got the jury instructions yesterday and started deliberating at about 11:30, 11:40 in the morning.
Jurors return tomorrow morning to continue deliberations. Brian Koberger, the man accused of murdering four University of Idaho students in 2022, has accepted a plea deal, according to a letter sent by prosecutors to the victims' families. CBS's Andres Gutierrez with more.
Tomorrow, Brian Koberger will stand in front of an Idaho judge and change his plea to guilty to four.